a discussion with Congressman Ken Calvert about his work in Congress and on curbing defense spending. Today, February 21st, 2023. Good morning, early birds. I'm Jonathan Lehrfeld, and this is the Early Bird Brief, produced by Defense News and Military Times. For today's episode, Defense News congressional reporter Bryant Harris spoke with Congressman Ken Calvert, a Republican from California and chairman of the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee, about the congressman's priorities this Congress and some potential Defense Department cost-cutting measures.
Well, thank you so much for coming on here. We really appreciate it. You know, obviously, there's a new Congress. You have a new role as chairman of the Appropriations Defense Subcommittee. So I'm wondering, just to start off with, if you could outline some of your priorities on that subcommittee as we look forward to the 2024 appropriation cycle.
Well, as you know, the Department of Defense is the largest enterprise in the world. Obviously, it has a budget closing in on $850 billion, about 3.2 million people, both civilian and military, that work there. Unfortunately, there's a lot of business practices that the Pentagon has not taken up, and the way they handle a lot of day-to-day business like personnel, accounts payable, procurement, we can go on and on and on, that needs reform. And we want to bring the department into the 20th century, and at the same time strengthen the military for the men and women who serve in the military. Because that's what it's all about, the people who serve there every day, that they have the best quality of life that we can afford, that we give them the equipment that they need, and if we get in a fight, we win, they lose.
Yeah, you mentioned some potential reforms like personnel and accounts payable. Can you elaborate a bit more on what you have on mind there?
Well, the way we handle, for instance, accounts payable, the way the bills are paid, the way I look at it as a business guy, it's somewhat antiquated. So we need to digitize processes in which the business is operating, which they have not done. We need to take a look at the civilian personnel, which is the highest number relative to uniform force throughout the business. This is primarily in the middle management. I'm not talking about depots or the wrench turners. I'm talking about the way we operate various parts. When I say DOD, it's not just the Pentagon, but it's the CIA, it's the NSA, it's the NRO, it's a combination of alphabet soup that's spread across the entire enterprise. And so all of that needs to be reformed and be as efficient as possible. And I'm not talking about firing a bunch of people, but over a period of time, bring the historic ratio of civilian employees relative to uniform force back to where it should be. If we did that one thing, it would save $125 billion over 5 years. And that's real money where I come from. And so that's something that we can do relatively painlessly. Any large business, you got about a 5% turnover ratio per year. And so if you hire 3% rather than 5%, you get a reduction over a period of time that will have a significant impact on the bottom line. Because remember, our highest cost is personnel because we have a volunteer service. And so we have to pay our people. We're not paying them enough. The E1s through E8s, for instance, are not being paid enough, or E9s, I should say. And so we need to bring that salary up for they can have a better quality of life. And so we need to find savings elsewhere in the Pentagon, or DOD, I should say, in order to take care of those young people where they have a better quality of life. That's part of the recruitment problems we're having, amongst other things. But that is a big part of it. Right now, an E1 enters in at $11 an hour. McDonald's is hiring at $15 to $20 an hour. So we got to get those salary levels up.
Yeah, I have heard some of your colleagues in the last few weeks start to talk about this a bit more, and they have mentioned the potential savings from the civilian personnel reforms. You know, this isn't something new. I think you yourself have mentioned this in the past before, but this dialogue seemed to have started shortly after the agreement Speaker McCarthy made to stay on fiscal 22 spending levels.
Right.
So with regards to the 2024 spending levels, you know, Speaker McCarthy hasn't completely ruled out defense cuts. Are you thinking that maybe some of these savings could translate to a lower Defense Department top line?
Well, at the same time that we create these efficiencies and find ways that we can save money, for instance, on the number of things that we're spending money on that we shouldn't be spending money on, and so we'll find some initial cuts in the Pentagon, and when I say Pentagon, throughout the Department of Defense, that will not hurt capability. We want to maintain capability and enhance capability. We still need to build fighter jets. We need to build bombers, the new B-21. We need to replace a lot of old equipment that we've been at war for 20 years. So at the same time, fix the procurement system in which we acquire this equipment, because that's an antiquated system. And Congress has a lot to blame, because we've added these requirements over the years. And so now it's gotten so complex that it takes a ridiculous amount of time to get anything. You know, I remember General Casey years ago saying, if we're lucky, we can find a replacement vehicle for the Humvee. And I don't think it was like 7 years. I said, well, hell, we won World War II in 4, for God's sake, and we can't replace a basic Humvee-type vehicle, even though, that you know, obviously the new technologies we have to put on that to protect the occupants. But nonetheless, it's ridiculous how long it takes to get from point of conception to the point of procurement, and that we have to shorten that time frame, because that costs money and could cost lives.
And sort of related to that, I know Chairman Rogers on Armed Services, he has, you know, started to talk a bit more about divesting from legacy platforms as another source of savings. Is there a role for the Defense Appropriations?
And by the way, you know, Mike and I are going to work very closely together. Adam, I've known Adam for a long time, and you know, we all know, and of course Betty, you know, we have a good working relationship. And there's a lot of things that I think we can all agree on, both Republican and Democrat side, that, you know, there's no reason for us to waste money and to do things that we've done in the past poorly. And so we need to come together to come up with ideas to do things more effectively and more efficiently.
Right. And once you have an idea of, you know, what's possible in terms of savings, how does that factor into this debate about the defense top line right now? Are we looking at, before, you know, people such as yourself have asked for a 3-5% increase over inflation?
The Mattis National Defense Strategy laid down a net 3-5% per year for our national security. I think that Mike agrees to that. I think Adam agrees to that. I agree to that. I have to ask Adam that, I should say. But and, you know, I think that's where we need to be. But at the same time, as we save money in the operations, not hurting our capability, but enhancing our capability. For instance, the best war is no war. And so I'm a real believer in deterrent. And so if we can get deterrent into Taiwan as rapidly as possible, for China will not make a poor decision like Putin made in going into Ukraine. You know, is to make sure that the cost of Xi going into Taiwan is such that he decides not to do it. We have little time to waste. I agree with our commander of the Air Mobility Command that this may happen sooner than later, so we need to be prepared, prepare as quickly as possible. So whatever money we save, we need to enhance our capability and to make sure we get deterrence to the folks who need it, to make sure we don't have a war, because a war is a hell of a lot more money than anything else. It's not just money, it's blood and treasure. And so we don't want to have to send our men or women into harm's way if we don't have to.
So it's less about the top line and more where that money's going and how it's being spent?
Yeah, we need to make sure that every nickel and dime that we spend is going to the core mission. The Pentagon has been used over the years, you know, as some kind of a social experiment. That's not me. You know, I think they have, just like a business guy, if I'm back in the restaurant business, I want to serve you the best meal you can possibly have and the best service that I can provide for a fair price. And so that's, you know, I know it's being simplistic, but that's what we need to do in the Pentagon. We need to make sure that we provide the most effective defense for the dollar that we can pay for.
Yeah, and as you noted, Ukraine and Taiwan are both a big part of that. On Ukraine, now that Russia's invaded, factoring to the defense spending issue, Congress passed 4 supplementals for over $60 billion to support Ukraine. So, you know, the strategy has been effective, but it's also very expensive. So I guess going forward, depending on how long the war lasts, are we looking at maybe more supplementals, putting it in the regular appropriations process?
Yeah. First, I'd say I wish we never had this conflict. We should not have been in it. If we have been doing what we should have been doing, is providing the deterrence to Ukraine earlier, Mr. Putin may have made a different decision. Unfortunately, he, I think, made a poor decision. And now the world is paying the consequence of that. His invasion of a democratically elected ally, disrupting not just Ukraine, but Europe and the entire world. And so how we deal with it is important. I think if the right decisions had been made sooner, that wouldn't have happened, but they did it, and now we're in this thing. And once you have a war, it's hard to stop one. We found out as Americans for the last 20-some years. You know, I'd like to see this end as soon as possible. The Europeans need to step up more. They have a responsibility. It's their neighborhood, especially the Germans. And they're beginning to come forward with some assistance, but I think they need to do a lot more. So does the rest of Europe. You know, obviously Poland and Romania are doing their share. Seems like the old European countries that were occupied by the former Soviet Union understand the consequences of this much better. I was out in the neighborhood there on a trip a number of months ago, and a Ukrainian explained to me how much they disliked the Russians. Very vivid language. And it goes back a long way. As you remember your history, Stalin killed 20 million of them, and they have a long memory of that, and they're not going back to that. Irregardless of our intervention, when I say our intervention financially, or the European, the Ukrainians were not going to give that up. It would have been an insurgency there, in my opinion, that would have lasted for a long time. So hopefully Mr. Putin will find an off-ramp on this.
And it's already hard to get spending agreements through here. It seems to get harder every year with the growing portion of your caucus that doesn't like spending this money in Ukraine. Do you think that's going to make the appropriations debate more difficult with regards to Ukraine spending?
The administration has not done a good job of explaining to the American public why it's important that the United States prevail in supplying our ally Ukraine. We haven't lost one U.S. troop, and the Russian military capability has been devastated. Some numbers I've seen, up to 60% of their military, conventional military capability has been destroyed. Not to mention the financial devastation in Russia and the Russian people. Unfortunately, the propaganda that's there, because they don't have a free press, they don't have any ability to get information, you know, through other methods, they're not getting the information they need to know that what's going on. They don't know that there's been 200,000 Russian casualties in this war. And these are devastating casualties. This is going back to World War I. This is artillery on both sides, hundreds of thousands of rounds, probably over 50,000 KIA in the Russians. And this can't continue. The world has to come together to apply pressure on Mr. Putin to come to a negotiated settlement to end this as soon as possible. And the Europeans have to be a big part of that. Think about it. I mean, heck, would he have foreseen that Sweden and Finland would have become part of NATO, for goodness sake? Everything he did there has gone wrong.
And one thing the Ukraine war has also highlighted are the pressures on our own industrial base as we continue to support them with weapons and munitions. Yeah. And that calls into question our ability to do the same with Taiwan. Is there going to be...
I think that people are kind of overreacting. I mean, unfortunately, some statements have been made by some folks that were saying what had done to our internal stock of weaponry. I want people to understand that we have a significant amount of capability to defend ourselves. At the same time, it does bring a point up. I mean, that's a legitimate point that you have on the supply chain problems, on re-energizing cold lines, for like on the Stinger missile or the Javelin, and how we get production numbers up, how we, just on the 155 rounds, you know, we have to increase the production on that. We have other allies that make equivalent rounds, and we need to work together to do that. We can't do everything by ourselves. You know, a lot of people would like that, but we can't afford to do that. And so we need to have our allies step up, whether it's the Germans coming in with their Leopard tanks or with other material, or with Poland giving up a lot of their old Soviet era munitions, which the Ukrainians can use or trained up on. Romanians the same way, the Balkan states, all the rest of it. So it's a team effort. But at the end, the Europeans, if Putin sees the Europeans allied together, help Ukraine prevail, that will bring him to the table. If he sees a fracture, that he won't. And that goes back to Taiwan. The best war is no war. That's why we need to make sure that the Taiwanese are not just armed, but trained. The California National Guard actually was in Ukraine for the last 20-some years, training up the Ukrainian army. The secret to their success is the non-commissioned officer corps. Russians are a hierarchy military. That's one of the reasons they've failed. That doesn't work in modern warfare. Everybody knows in American military, the sergeants run the military. Generals just think they do. The sergeants are the guys that are in the field. They understand the men and women they're fighting with. And the Taiwanese need to learn the same lessons, by the way, because the Asian hierarchy system is similar to what Russians is. So be trained up, need to be open to that.
Yeah.
Not just munitions.
So looking to China and the Pacific more broadly, with this increased attention, especially from the House on China, do you think there may be any big shakeups in terms of funding requirements for the Defense Department in the Pacific in this coming fiscal year or future fiscal year?
Well, we started out with Obama, the so-called shift to the Pacific, mm-hmm. but we never really did. We've fallen behind on ship production. The Chinese are up to well over 360 ships, and they're capable ships. We're down to 260 or so. Just in that number alone is a glaring, because numbers matter. We may have more capable ships, and I believe we do, but numbers in the end matter. Just like in the Roman Empire, you still had to have a guard on one end of the bridge and a guard on the other. That hasn't changed. You still have to have presence, and presence can only be developed by numbers, and numbers mean money. And so we need more ships. We need the personnel to operate those ships, if we can get more efficient in how we do it, and new ship design and so forth. We need submarines, which is probably our best asset out there right now. I love aircraft carriers. The Navy obviously has married themselves to that projection of power, and we just need to make sure we can defend it and that we can send it out, and we're confident that there's always risk. By the way, we've become so risk adverse that it's, getting back to the procurement side of it, it's just cost us a whole lot. There's never zero risk to send out an aircraft carrier with the 5,000 souls and the $20 billion that aircraft carrier represents from the time that you build it and then you load it up with the F-35s and the rest of it. It's the Dark Star. It goes out there. It's an impressive sight. You just want to make sure it's protected.
And my last question is on supply chains, critical minerals, actually, because I know you introduced some legislation in the last Congress to sort of onshore critical minerals, which are integral to our defense industrial base and the broader economy. Do you anticipate work on that in this session?
We have the minerals here in the United States. We just need to get access to them. We got to work, with the states and the communities to get access to those rare earths and make sure that we have our own strategic stockpile, which we need to have, not just for the military, by the way, but for the entire civilian technical infrastructure. You can't make anything without, it seems, chips. The need for those so-called rare earths are getting more and more necessary by the day. And we can't depend on China or Russia to give those materials to us. Happily, they found a significant supply in Sweden, which is nice. It's good to have an ally to have that kind of thing. But we need to have our own supply, too. As a matter of fact, the largest mine in the United States is right in my neighborhood out in San Bernardino, California. We need more of it in the United States.
Well, thank you so much, Congressman. I really appreciate you making the time to chat
with
us. Great.
Thank you. Yeah.
That's it for us this morning. To get more of the top stories and breaking news, go to defensenews.com/EBB to subscribe to the Early Bird Brief newsletter. If you liked what you heard, give us a like wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to follow us on social media @defense_news and @MilitaryTimes. The Early Bird Brief is hosted by me, Jonathan Lehrfeld, and produced by Zimone Z. Perez. If you liked our conversation today, be sure to check out Brian's work at defensenews.com. Also, please rate us and be sure to leave a comment on whatever platform you use. Our editor-in-chief is Mike Roos. Have a great day.